When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This week we're speaking with Oscar McMahon and Richard Adamson from Young Henry's. You guys know it, it's a fantastic beer made in Newtown and brewed to serve the people. Let's go. All right, cool. Let's start. Welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. We'd like to begin with an acknowledgement of country and acknowledge the Gadigal and Wangal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather today, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. All right, Simon, our guests today, we're very lucky to have or to be here at the Young Henry's Brewery in Newtown. Welcome, Rich and Oscar from Young Henry's.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, hey, fellas.
No worries. All right, guys, just to start, do you want to tell us a bit about your sort of respective roles in the business?
Ooh, that's changed a lot. So I think when Oscar and I were the founders of Young Henry's, and we brought on Dan Hampton, our sales director. I think it sounds a little bit officious, doesn't it?
It does.
Sales dude. Probably about 6 to 8 months into when we first started. But I was the head brewer. Oscar was also brewing, and we were barely doing sales and keeping the place afloat at that time. And now I kind of look after the technical side of brewing. We'll assist the head brewer there and sort of do special projects, I guess. Yeah.
And I guess that I sort of sit across a marketing and brewing sort of, I guess, the marketing team, sort of sitting in the marketing meetings every week and working with them sort of on a more day-to-day with certain things. But also my interactions with the brewing team is sort of less technical and more to do with like morale and team, stuff like that. And we both put out fires. Anytime something is on fire, run towards it with fire blanket.
Yeah. I think your role's probably got more specific now, but I guess it's still, if there's a problem, if there's something to be fixed, then you're still rolling your sleeves up.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Cool. And so your guys here every day, this is your workplace?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've got our office is just over there. There's four of us in our office. It's just above the brewery. So, you know, we'll be sitting at our computers or chatting through something and all of a sudden the compressor will stop working and everyone just listens out for, hang on, it's gone quiet. Why did it go quiet? You don't like quiet breweries.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you're recording a podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Pretty impossible to happen. Yeah. Yeah. Lock the room down.
Guys, I guess to start, almost more so than any other beer that I can think about, you guys are connected to a place. And Newtown is a very special and unique place. And you guys have roots here. Do you want to tell us, when you first started the business, we'll start with you, Oscar, tell us a bit about what Newtown was like. There might be some people listening to this who don't know much about Newtown and about what it was like and why you thought bringing a beer to Newtown that followed the sense of place that you have here would be something that would work.
Newtown, you know, 8-9 years ago was a late night pub district. It was a restaurant district. It was, but it wasn't sort of heralded as that. If that makes any sense, it was a place where a lot of locals would go out to eat and drink. It wasn't necessarily a huge culinary destination. Then you had the likes of Bloodwood opening up and Hart's Yard and a bunch of the pubs started, you know, putting on better produce. And then obviously when the lockouts sort of happened, it became this real focus of nightlife, you know. But back then, I think Newtown was this really vibrant locals, really local friendly place. And a lot of people were going out and drinking beer in pubs. And that's what, I mean, we love this area. I love living in this area. And we love the pubs of the area. So it just sort of, I don't know, from a brand point of view, I guess it made more sense from how we felt opening a business here than any other well thought out business plan of, well, you know, the people of Newtown are going to love this. No, we just thought this is a good place. This is where we feel comfortable. So let's open a business here.
Were you only going to open the brewery in Newtown? Were you looking other places, or was we were looking,
to be honest, at anywhere that had a very specific, you know, size and zoning.
Yeah. So it kind of was almost luck that you found the spot here in Newtown.
It's almost the last industrial space within Newtown left, I think, is where we are now. Murrayfield sells a fair bit, but in terms of that sort of businesses are getting pushed out from the city, I think, further and further.
Mm. Did you envision having as much of a connection to place as you guys now do?
Initially, it was more about having a community around us. So we chose Serve the People as a bit of a pun, but also we wanted to live that in some way that made sense to us, and that was going to be to bring in things or, you know, people, businesses, bands, artists that inspired us, and hopefully we could do a little bit towards what they did by inspiring them with beer or just getting involved with what they were doing. And that was the original vision. I guess as it turns out, Newtown is full of musicians and artists, so that worked. That played to us pretty well, as it turned out. And then we were asked by the council to do a beer for Newtown's 150th anniversary, which we called the Newtowner. And I guess that really kind of cemented it at that point.
I think without that, without kind of hitting that or making that beer, how different things would be now? Do you think you would have carried on the trajectory, or
you know what?
How important was that beer?
That beer, I think, was a huge turning point for us. It was. It was. I mean, we legitimately made Newtowner for the first time as a small batch.
Yeah.
You know, it was the first time that the Courthouse Hotel had ever put us on tap, and which we thought is the quintessential, you know, Newtown pub.
Yeah.
And they went through a batch of beer in a week. One pub. A whole batch of beer in 1 week.
Which made me very nervous.
Yeah, exactly. We'd never seen
it. It was your
like
job,
that.
Rich, to get it out.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Thinking this is going to eat the brewery. But we got through. There was a period there, I think after that beer, that we said no to new customers for a good 8 months or so.
Mm. Probably more.
Probably more.
And then we had this... Once we sort of hit capacity, because Newtown had just started taking off, We actually had to put in a mechanism for saying no to people who wanted to, like, this sounds crazy, but the publicans calling wanting to put this beer on tap, and we only had so much. Mm. So we had to work out a way of saying no to people. So we just said, okay, if your pub isn't in the 2042 postcode, I'm sorry, you can't have it.
So that was more a logistic thing than a locals only kind of thing.
Yeah, it was not a constructed marketing ploy, like, oh, we're gonna hold it back for a little while. It was just like, no, that's all we've got. So it's called the Newtowner. We should let, you know, the local people have it first. And a couple of people along the way just was saying, this is fucking madness. So you've got a product that people want to buy and you're telling them no? Like, yeah, that doesn't really sound smart, does it?
How long between releasing that beer and then expanding to, like, how long did you wait? Because I guess the temptation would be to expand. You know, you've got this demand, so expand real quick, pump out as much beer, maybe cut corners, maybe do this.
Again, it probably wasn't any strategy. It was, can we get the money together? Can we get the space? Yeah. I think at that time, we were only two of the, how many are there? Five warehouses in this facility. And it was only until the third one came available that we could actually do the expansion. We were totally out of space. So we only started with two of these warehouses, and now we've taken over the entire site, slowly but surely. Mm. So again, yeah, I don't think it was a strategy. It was just, as a physical barrier.
We could not make enough.
Yeah.
And then when we're talking about sort of reinvesting again, putting in some more tanks, we flicked an email to a few of our sort of favorite licensees around the area, and we just said, look, how would you guys feel about us letting Newtowner out of Newtown? And all of them, they were like, look, take it to the world, but just make sure we don't run out.
Yeah.
And that was the main feedback.
On first dibs.
Yeah, exactly. So that was pretty cool. Mm. And the important thing with Newtown, and why we're really lucky to have found this place, is that we have gained a lot of knowledge and insight into what we're doing, what people like, because people come into our tasting bar and they hang out and they have chats. All of our customers have become friends. It's amazing when you're standing in the front bar of a local pub what you can learn if you just have chats with people. Mm-hmm. And, like Newtown has influenced our business in that way ever since day dot. So it's, I do feel like we've done some really positive things for Newtown, but Newtown has also helped guide this business in many different ways.
Was there any kind of backlash or negativity to what you guys were doing? Or sort of maybe from the more traditional beer drinkers? And
Of course. You can't do anything fun without someone getting their nose out of joint. But,
pretty much. Yeah.
Look, are you pro-party or anti-party?
I think you guys would know too. If you create something, you open yourself up to criticism.
Oh, yeah.
You got to take... the good with the bad in terms of that criticism. Some people are going to love what you do, and some people are just going to find a way of picking holes in it. Sometimes legitimately, and sometimes you go, maybe that's not that fair, but I've got to cop it on the chin.
Yeah.
I think also that from the very beginning, we didn't do... There was no market research done. We very much wanted to... We just started making things and, we'd be talking about, sometimes like Rich would come up with just a pun idea, and we'd base like, oh, do you know what? Let's make a beer to suit that pun. Yeah. It was all just...
That's how this guy writes his menu.
Yeah. I'm sorry to say that. Well, literally I find like bacon eggs, and it's like, let's do fish bacon and fish eggs. And it's like, I only want to do it because of the little pun.
Yeah.
Like, that's literally the best way to start. As long as it makes you laugh, then you'd be a bit more invested in it or something.
So we, from the very beginning, it was a lot of... trusting your gut, just being legitimately excited by something. And if you're making decisions based on something that you actually love and really think is funny or really enjoy, it doesn't really matter if someone doesn't like it, because if you like it, you know that your friends and other people who have the same sense of humor will appreciate it. And if someone else doesn't like it, it's really not an issue, because... Yeah, it's cool. Like, as long as you're satisfied with that.
It'd be worse if you made a beer or made a dish to please someone and then they didn't like it. You get fucked on both
sides.
Yeah,
that's right. You haven't pleased yourself and you haven't pleased them. So that's
the pissed off.
That's the worst of both worlds, unfortunately.
Was that though a difficult sort of realization to come to? Because I think that you guys obviously like unorthodox beginnings, not huge amounts of experience in running a brewery and upscaling business and doing all those sorts of things. But was it a hard realization to come to that you could just trust your gut and just trust what you find interesting? Because we live in a world now where there's a lot more of these unorthodox approaches to things available. Before the internet and social media, in a way... The corporate world and the way that marketing was conducted and stuff was very polished and very almost sterile in a way, but it's taken sort of the internet, social media and things like that to allow people to be themselves and to use genuine excitement and interest to drive a lot of their decision making. And it's more acceptable now at a corporate level or at a large business level. Was it hard to be like, this is how everyone else is doing it and they're all successful, we're going to do it completely differently and just trust our gut and, you know, trust the fact that we all enjoy like getting loose sometimes and making bad puns, and we're going to make decisions based on this sort of thing?
I think I just before we sort of opened the doors, I'd read a book called Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know if you've read that. He says that those gut decisions are probably more complex than you give it credit for. You're making a whole bunch of decisions very quickly. And just because you haven't sat down and written them all down and gone through it methodically doesn't mean that you haven't really thought about it or given it due consideration. And I always think that if you have that gut feeling that this is right, and then you go through the intellectual process of mapping it all out and you decide to be cautious and not do it, and it turns out you were right, I think that's the most when I get the most annoyed with myself. When you go against your gut and your gut was right. So going with your gut and occasionally getting it wrong, I think is a better outcome.
I actually think that our gut reflex got tested a couple of times in the early days by a couple of the times where we did fuck up or something went wrong, and one of us, you know, has said, you know what, I had a feeling that we shouldn't have done that and I didn't voice it. You know, any time that there's a sort of a big mistake, someone had a feeling of trepidation or, you know, it is a pretty pretty important muscle to flex, you know, and we've gotten better at that. So now it's all gut feel and then we check the spreadsheets afterwards.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Because any business, any industry, you're going to have failures. I think it's how you deal with them afterwards and how you look back on them, what you learn from them, and if that's what you guys took, was that next time someone fucking pipe up.
Absolutely. Not right. Absolutely.
Then that's a pretty good lesson to take from
there's
it.
There's absolutely no point in someone sitting back and eventually saying, I told you so. No, come on. If you've got a dodgy feeling, like, let's talk about it right now.
What were one of the fuck-ups?
Oh, there's so many. particularly in the early days, I think you do have to throw up a lot of ideas up against the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
When you first start, because you really don't have that much to lose. Let's face it.
Yeah.
You know, I think now the expectation of starting a brewery, you've got to get it right, bang on from the outset. There's a lot of people. The
competition is.
But yeah, a lot of people looking at you. I think it's. It's much harder these days. It's kind of like when people come and review the restaurant and they come in the first 2 weeks, you know, when you're still working stuff out. They don't come 3 months into you being open.
They make a decision straight away. They go, I didn't like it. I'm not going to go back.
Which is a stitch up. The staff didn't know what they were doing. They've been on the job for two weeks, mate. Like,
sometimes they come in the first night to do a review.
Can you send me in the review that you wrote on your first day working for this newspaper, and I'm going to fucking review that.
Exactly.
How about that, pal?
We didn't answer the question. We sidestepped that one very well, didn't we? Look, there's been some limited release beers that haven't hit the mark. We were way ahead of our time in kombucha beer, and there's a reason for that because it wasn't that good.
I don't remember that one.
The thing that sticks out in my head was the first time we entered the market doing a packaged product were these long necks that we got a cheap deal on from a company from China, and it turned
out that's a reason why they're cheap.
Oh, the actual bottles.
The actual bottles started popping on the shelves the first week we released them, and someone picked one up and it broke in his hand. Fuck. And that was a really scary time. Thankfully we were super small and we knew the five customers that had bought it. We could just drove up and picked it all up and, you know, had to destroy it all. But that was a scary thing where, you know, logic tells you, don't buy cheap glass.
Yeah.
You know?
But yeah, that's the pressures when you're small and you're new.
It's absolutely.
Like, if I can save, you know, however much per bottle,
yeah,
that all makes such a difference at the time. Mm. Like, it's always kind of a new business. It's working out where you can put your money, where you might need to like kind of cop back a bit, where you might need these IKEA plates or these,
these handmade ceramics.
Yeah. Handmade ceramics. So, you know, it's the secret of the restaurant world.
But yeah, IKEA for sure. Plates. IKEA?
Yeah.
That's what
came up.
Yeah, especially if you're in good one Scandinavia. Guys, another thing, I guess, it, like, continuing along sort of what we're talking about and that gut feel and stuff, it sounds, I mean, some people find it really boring to talk about brands and branding, and it can be really boring. But, like, I'm not a marketing guru in any sense, but your brand is so recognizable for its like authenticity, and it's just like every collaboration you have, or every new beer that you put out, or where you see it or how you see it, is so well aligned. Yet the way that you talk about your beginnings, it doesn't sound like you would have even really talked about the brand in
that's
general.
Actually something we talked about a lot. In terms of getting putting down the values that we wanted this company to represent,
right,
and in some way about how we're going to go about it. We probably talked about that the most.
Yeah, absolutely. So
that was thought out. That was a long conversation. And we wanted to make sure that everyone was, you know, involved in the company to start with was on the same page.
Interesting.
So I really think that's super important when you start a business, that you have the same aims and same ethos, because there's nothing worse than starting the company and then 18 months later realizing that, oh, you never talked about that from the start, and the company's gone left when you thought it was going to go right. And that's, you know, one person's happy and the other person isn't.
I think also in how do you make a beer taste a certain way, look a certain way? How do you make a t-shirt communicate in the same sort of way? How do you make a mural? How do you get all of those different, like those four or five different creative outlets, how do you make them all make sense together? You know, you've got someone brewing, you've got a graphic designer, you've got a street artist doing the mural. What is the one thing that actually ties all those things together? And it actually is taking it right back to the values of the company and making sure that if those values are in check, you will actually use those values when you are hiring people, when you're engaging with artists, and when, you know, when you're coming up with beer recipes. If you have a commonality, which is a mindset or a set of values, and that is what you use to determine your decision making into all of those different facets, you actually start having a bit of a throughput. And I can only really say that with the addition of hindsight. But, you know, from having those early conversations, like when we were looking to hire our first salesperson, Dan, our business partner, was asking, look, do you guys have anything? I mean, like, we all know what Young Henry's is. Do you guys have anything that we could actually, you know, show to someone else? And we dug up this this stuff that going through, when we were going through working out what the brand was going to be, we had this list of values of what we wanted Young Henry's to be. And we still read that to new employees when they join Young Henry's.
It was like an original list you guys wrote down.
It really, the core hasn't changed. I think we've probably got a little bit more sophisticated in how we articulate it. But in terms of what we're after was really that being genuine and being able to help tell other people's stories. And as I said before, bring other people into the business that inspired us. So when we do a collaboration, we're really looking to help tell somewhat of their story and maybe a common narrative that we have together, and try and tell that through the ingredients that we're using, or how the beer's made, or how we launch it.
Yeah, highlighting a parallel in something. So, you know, actually having a common goal that we're both working towards, which is, if you think about it, beer company, really what we're doing is we're constantly making things. We constantly have to be creative. So collaboration actually offers you, you're basically throwing out an idea and you're saying, we need to be creative here. You're setting yourself a task. You need to be creative on something that will suit Young Henry's, but also suit another partner. And you have to be thinking, you know, like if you're making a beer with a musician, how does that work? What is that going to look like? What is that? What's going to be the launch party? You know.
And yeah. So you know, a good example would have been the Offends Hemp IPA. So it was just after hemp became legal as a food additive, hemp oil, and Offends work a lot with hemp in their fabrics. Mm. So it's part of their brand identity a lot is that sustainable angle with hemp and using a fairly novel fabric as well. And then we had a novel ingredient to work with. A lot of people had gone down the path of using just the seeds themselves, roasted hemp seeds. We found some really interesting guys that had worked on water solubility for hemp oil, which really kept the flavor into something that was more akin to hops, but also reminded you of hemp, I guess, as well. So that took a lot of work to get that right, but I think the results were certainly worth it in the end.
Amazing. All right. Well, like, I guess the interesting thing that you guys are talking about, and I guess the reason why, like, I guess my first question was about how much thought was put into the brand. And I guess I had an assumption, not an assumption, but a lot of people when they're creating a business, instead of following what they're interested in and trusting what they're interested in and the immediate group of people around are interested in, whether it's arts and music and beer and those sorts of things, or whether it's something completely different, a brand a lot of the time is created to please a marketplace rather than to also please the people that are involved and invested in that brand. And I think that's what, I guess, makes, and you can agree with me or disagree with me, but one of the things that makes your brand so strong is that it's you guys and it's the people around you and it's the people in Newtown and it's all these things that it's, you were talking about an ethos and a set of values, and that's your brand. You guys are your brand, not this is how we want to make money. And this is
it's kind of wider than that now too. I actually don't feel like that we own the brand anymore. I think it's got a life of its own. And we're very fortunate. We've got an amazing team that really embody that culture as well. So the Young Henry's culture has evolved slightly from when we started, but I think the core's definitely there. I tend to think things like market research, you just end up with something bland, something inoffensive, that doesn't have much character. You know, it's kind of back to Malcolm Gladwell's book. There's not a spaghetti sauce for people. There's spaghetti sauces.
You know, one of the things I think about is that in the early days, the word exit strategy was never considered or even discussed. And I think that, you know, in a strange way, I mean, if you can listen to an investor podcast and one investor will say, never invest in anyone without an exit strategy. You're like, well, why would you invest on someone with their eye on the door already?
Yeah.
You know,
like, why would you be that pessimistic when you're trying to do something for love and be like, right, first things first, let's work out what's going to happen if we fuck up.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, cool. Well,
and exactly, or if you get right? Too good.
Or make so much money. I actually like this job.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, right? Without an exit strategy, you actually have to make things that make decisions that will suit you because you're going to be living with it. You know? And that's something that we always just did because, well, there's still no exit strategy. We're just in this, you know. It's like, are we still having fun? Yep. Have we sunk it yet? No. Cool. Let's keep going.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's talk a bit about craft beer in general. Do you want to just start, Rich?
Sorry, I'm laughing about that already. It's just such a can of worms you've opened.
Craft beer. It is such a can of worms. That's the thing. It's funny. See, we're like, like it's like we almost don't even have to have the conversation because everyone will just like roll their eyes and be like, oh yeah, okay, where are we going with this? But Rich, what can you give us your 2 cents on what the landscape was like when you started of craft beer? And it, like, I can sort of remember back then, but you'd obviously be able to tell us a bit better.
Look, it was run. There was a lot of corporate craft, and really, after the 90s and the recession, we had to have a lot of those original sort of craft breweries that started around the same time as the American craft beer revolution. They either fell by the wayside or they got sucked up by the big guys. Mm. And when we were looking at it in the, you know, back in the, how long ago was it, Oscar? 2012. There wasn't that much on the landscape. There was probably, you know, I'd been involved with the brewing company before. I think it was just starting to find its feet. But certainly if you walked around Newtown, there wasn't that many craft beers on tap. I can't really think of any independently owned craft beer that you saw on a regular basis.
And even in bottle shops, you know, if you're heading out to a party and, you know, you wanted to take a selection of interesting things, you were traveling to a specific bottle shop. You weren't just popping to your local one.
Mm.
You know, like you might get some Cooper's Red if you were lucky at your local bottle shop, but, you know, and that was a really, that was just how it was, you know, like people didn't expect to see an independent, you know, craft beer on tap, and kind of didn't really, no one really missed it either until it happened. Then all of a sudden people can't live without it, you know.
It's a great time to be a beer drinker. There's so much more choice out there than there ever was. I kind of get the feeling it's a little like when that grunge music exploded in the 90s, right? Because it was everyone's little underground scene. Mm. You know, you go and see your little underground band at the pub, and then Nirvana happened, and all of a sudden, what was yours and what was cool was now mainstream. Mm. There is an element of that, I think, within the craft beer community now. It's like, oh, well, that beer's drunk by people that aren't that cool. which kind of goes against the entire ethos of what we're, you know, I think what craft beer is about, and that is to bring good beer to people. Yeah.
There's the kind of thing about when you see people who didn't want to get about it or didn't have any respect for it or didn't even think about it until people started drinking it, and then they were jumping on it. There's going to be bigger pubs who would never have, you know, a small craft beer on tap, and now they see the value of it and they're trying to stock up on these things.
That's great. I don't have an issue with that.
Yeah.
Not morally or aesthetically or anything. I think that's, you know, we're about getting good beer into more people's hands.
I think craft as a word sort of defines itself. Yeah. Something that is well crafted, it is, you know, made by people with love and care. Right? That's probably the most important part of, you know, the whole craft beer industry. But what has made it fun and interesting is the independent craft beer companies, because they're small companies made by, look, basically a bunch of pirates and piss heads who actually really give a fuck about what they're making. And that's what makes the industry fun. You've got a lot of people. Everyone drinks each other's beers. Everyone knows each other.
It is a bunch of mavericks, and it's a fun industry. And I've never met a bigger bunch of crazies, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is.
I say that lovingly.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's kind of like,
this is why I'm in hospitality.
Exactly. It's like the hospitality industry, right? Yeah. You know, you might own, run, or work in the coolest bar in town. Mm. And guess what? That's not going to be the bar that you're drinking in on your night off. You're going to be down the road at your mate's pub or whatever it is. And especially in the early days of craft beer, that camaraderie of brewers dropping in and doing a brew day or just dropping in for beers at each other's stuff, it was really, really fun.
I remember Oscar saying in the first 6 months we had a lot of people come and visit, and he said, why is it now that I get given a lot of free craft beer when I own a brewery now?
Whereas
when I didn't own a brewery, I would get no free craft beer.
It's kind of like, you know, the whole thing that I think Brad Pitt said it in an interview. It's like, I became rich and famous and now I can afford to pay for all the things that people give me for free.
Yeah.
Do you, like, I mean, you just gave us a pretty clear definition of what craft means to people, Oscar. But
that's what craft means to me.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, though. But I think one of the things as well, which is kind of might be challenging for a organization like yours, is that it is sometimes also synonymous with small and small scale, and people sort of might not have an understanding of what independence really means and how independence allows you guys to keep quality with volume and things like that. Is that something that you guys think about when, you know, with an ever-increasing volume? Is it something that you guys think about that you're like, we don't ever want to feel like a major that has lost touch with where it started and the people that love the beer and things like that?
I think we're a long way from the power of the distribution that those major brewing companies have.
Mm.
And the ability to go into a pub and say, we want to tie up, you know, more than half of your taps, and if you do that, we'll give you a discount on spirits and a discount on your soft drinks. You know, we're none of us in, you know, they're independent, really have that ability to, you know, open their wallet and splash it around. On the positive side, I think it's really the ability to follow your whim and follow your gut, as we're talking about, without having to submit a marketing plan and a budget to head office. And if, you know, someone telling you that's a dumb idea, because a lot of our ideas are dumb ideas before they get off the ground. Yeah.
Some of our best ideas have been dumb ideas.
Or tenuous at best. Yeah, idea, not dumb, but tenuous. And then through saying, not just shutting things down, but saying, yes, it gets better because we knock it back and forth and knock it around. I think that, you know, Oscar said this before, that we respect good ideas. We respect ideas. And then ideas become good ideas after some work.
Mm. Do you think there's a kind of, is there like a maximum size or a maximum output you guys would aim for? Or would it just be, get bigger and bigger and bigger? Do you think there's a point where that would affect the brand?
I think that there is a natural ceiling for a brand like Young Henry's. We're never going to be everyone's cup of tea. Yeah. And that's okay. We're all right with that. A couple of years ago, we made an agreement as a group of directors that growth is only acceptable if we do it in our way. Yeah. You know, we're not going to sacrifice our values and the feeling of this company. We're not going to sacrifice all of that for growth. We don't want to just, it's, you know, that makes it shit.
Yeah.
The part that we're interested in, and that is the independent company bit, it's because we are able to make decisions. We're able to do things pretty fun. We're able to do things that no one in a big company would be able to do. And that's what makes it fun. That's why 80 people work for us. It's because it's fun. Mm. And we don't want to lose that. We don't want to lose that interest.
Pride in the beer we make and the ability to make a difference, I think, as well, within the organization and outside of that at the same time.
What do you guys think about the larger companies buying up craft breweries? What are your thoughts?
Look, it's, we know how hard it is to do this, so if that's the path that other breweries want to take, I can completely understand.
Mm.
It's probably a lot of money for them too.
Yeah,
you know?
It's very much a beer fanboy kind of thing of, no, they've sold out now, they've gone on this, but
look,
they're not
punk anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've got friends in many of those businesses that I'm still friends with now, and you know, I don't, they haven't changed as people. Maybe their outlook has changed somewhat, and that can evolve. And depends on what their aims were initially as well, I think. I don't have any issue with those people personally whatsoever.
And
yeah.
I think it's actually, in a strange way, it's a really significant sign of the times when you've got these monolithic, you know, multinational companies trying to stay relevant by buying independent companies that are doing things that they could never have done.
Yeah.
You know, I actually think, well, if
it's a testament to their success, isn't it?
Absolutely, it is. Sure. And it's also a testament to the strength of independent craft beer. Because, well, hang on, if we're all doing something that they're willing to be jumping on and they can't do it, they need to acquire someone else, then surely we're doing something right here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's kind of exciting.
Mm. I guess it even means the standard of beer across the country kind of increases. If these big companies are buying these smaller breweries up and then getting them put on these larger pubs, I guess that's good for beer drinkers everywhere.
Certainly good for the consumer. Mm. Yeah, I think in some ways it is. It's the difficulty, I think, is around these tap contracts and whether that's anti-competitive. So, you know, it's great that they can offer that beer to the consumer. Is the consumer really getting more choice and better value for buck? I'd question that.
Mm.
Interesting.
Going back to the sort of craft beer industry now, obviously the competition's there, but we're just talking about, you know, majors buying up smaller breweries and things like that. Have you guys had to really think about competition now? Like, and as you said, you guys are mates with a lot of these people, like a lot of independent brewers and things like that. Have you guys had to have a think about how you're going to stay competitive when there's so many other people, independent brewers? Or
look, there are, when we started, there was around between 150 to 180 brewers. It's now over 650.
Fuck.
So the market has tripled in the last 8 years.
Mm.
We have the ability of, you know, time, tenure. We got into the market earlier and we have grown at a really great rate for the last few years.
Mm.
We're a few years ahead of other breweries in, you know, our business relationships and our distribution points, and so that's been a real benefit to us. But of course, we have to be considering what the market's going to do. We have to be thinking about what's next and how do we maintain our customers, because it's getting really competitive. There's, you know, 650 people.
It certainly keeps you sharp, so you're not, yeah, you know, you sit up straight, you're not, you know, resting on your laurels. You've got to really be in touch with what the customer wants, you know, both the punter drinking the beer and the people selling the beer at the pubs and bottle shops. We've got to keep reinventing and be creative, come up with some, you know, new ideas, and keep our consistency of our core products as well, to make sure that they're the best that they can be. And competition does that. It pushes you to be better.
Mm.
The other part of that is we need to keep reinvesting into our people and our company's journey so that we keep good people. We've got a really incredible team. And with that much competition out there, you know, if you've got an unhappy workforce, you've got a whole bunch of flight risks,
you know,
because there are 15 other breweries within 5Ks who are looking for people to hire, you know. It's, you have to sort of, yeah, it's a bit of a test, you know. You have to have a pretty well-rounded business to keep going through, you know.
Have you found that with such an expansion of breweries that there's not enough brewers to fill the roles? Have you lost brewers to other companies?
Well, what I did was I ended up at this business breakfast at Parliament House in New South Wales. I'm not really sure why I was there.
I was there.
I felt a little bit, you know, a little bit strange with the surrounded by all these suits.
Mm.
But the then Premier sat next to me and said, "What's the biggest challenge in your industry?" And I said, "Training. We need more brewers. It should be taught at TAFE." And he said, "Send me an email on that one," which I did, and I thought that would be the end of it. And then I got a call from the head of TAFE New South Wales saying, "I've been told to make this happen. What do I need to do?"
Yeah, wow.
And at that point I thought, oh shit, why did I open my big mouth? And then I handballed it to a friend of mine who was in education and brewing, and he started the course. And then I phoned him up about 9 months into it and said, "How are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm about to start teaching." I said, "Do you need a hand?" He said, "Yes." So I got involved with teaching at TAFE. So we've had, to date, 72 students come through. Majority of them are working in the brewing industry. I think our first class, it was 100% of students came through. And they're working all through the place. I think we've got we've got five in our brewing team that have been through the TAFE course. So that education certainly helped to fill that gap that was coming with the inevitable growth of the industry. Mm. There wasn't anything set up before through TAFE.
Was there no formal training for brewers? Was it all just someone who would teach you?
No, well, the course that I did was postgraduate, so you had to have a bachelor's degree at minimum, and it got to a stage where you needed to have a science degree, undergraduate.
I didn't get accepted.
which is, that's fine on that path, but that really you need people that have got hands-on practical skills, that have got some... Obviously, some theoretical backing to those practical skills, but it's not about necessarily about a postgraduate course when you really just need someone to come in and clean and fill kegs for you and work on the floor. I think that comes later in your career.
TAFE is a great model for brewing because it is theoretical and it is scientific, but it is also physical.
Yeah,
you know, so you can't just be an intellect. You need to be coordinated. You need to, you know.
It's practice, isn't it? It's a practice. It's absolutely. Like, it is like cooking. It's what are your nice skills like?
Yeah, you know. A lot of dirty work to it.
A lot of dirty work to it. We are glorified janitors in the end of the day.
Yeah.
I think people have this glamorous idea of brewing, but it's
mainly cleaning.
It's wax on, wax off.
Yeah. In the early days, because there wasn't anything like the TAFE course, if someone wanted to get a leg up in the industry, they would literally have to front up to a brewery and say, hey, look, I know that you're not hiring, but
I'll work for free.
I want some experience. Can you, if I give you, you know, a day a week, can you teach me a few things? And for that first year and a half to 2 years, when we were hardly paying ourselves, we couldn't afford to have many staff. And we had a few people who wanted to learn, wanted to, you know, get some skills, get some experience. And they would just turn up. We'd book them in, they'd have a day, they'd come in and they'd be working, and what they'd get out of it was knowledge at the end of the day. Mm. And there's now...
quite a few of those people ended up working with us and have gone on to do other things as well in the brewing industry. So a
couple of head brewers around the place.
Mm. I think that's kind of... So I always almost judge kitchen culture is how many chefs have come out of that kitchen to go on to be head chefs or go to own places. And I think that really shows the culture you have. So I guess it's the same here. If you've got this many people who are now head brewers somewhere, that shows that you guys are doing something pretty cool and very right.
Yeah, that's like absolutely a parallel. It's kind of... It's really cool if we think about the Young Henry's alumni and how many... great beers and great companies, and I don't know, that's actually a pretty cool feeling.
Yeah, I imagine it will be.
Cool. We'll shift slightly now. Sustainability is something that's important to you guys. Can we start, Rich, just tell us a little bit about maybe some of the first, you know, the first implementations of sort of sustainably conscious practices that you guys had in place here?
Yeah, the first thing we did was probably the growlers. So we had a 2-liter returnable bottle. And when we looked into packaging, we kind of realized that that's a fairly hefty carbon footprint. You know, a lot of people like to talk about recycling. I still unfortunately have doubts around glass recycling, whether it actually goes back into bottles. I think only a certain amount of glass can make it back in. We know that we were shipping a lot of glass to China. That stopped. We're having it rejected from Indonesia. Hopefully, we can start seeing a recycling industry in Australia that's homegrown. But at the moment, I'm still a little skeptical. But every time you reuse a bottle, that has an exponential impact on reducing your carbon footprint. So to be able to do that have a group of people that lived around the area that could bring their bottles back to the source, and we'd do a swap and go. So we would take that bottle, clean it, fill it properly under counter pressure, and then put it back in the fridge and give them a discount on that package as well. So have a value about the glass, I think, was really important.
Mm.
That was probably one of our, you know, hindsight being what it is, one of our best entries to the market were these big 2-liter brown bottles.
Was that not quite so done when you guys started that?
No.
Because it's kind of quite like almost every brewery you'd find would have that system in place now. Hey?
Exactly. Whereas people were like, oh, are you the big brown bottle guys? You know, yeah, right. you'd go around to different parties or, you know, you'd go see someone for dinner and there'd be one of our growlers on their shelves. Like it became this sort of mainstay in a West household.
That's awesome.
You know, even to the fact that
bottles lined up on the shelf.
We were walking down Edgware Road in Enmore on our way to a meeting, and we saw a real estate sign out the front of a house that was for sale, and in the photo of the backyard they had a Young Henry's growler in the center of the picnic table out the back as like a way of selling this property. We're like, wow, that's amazing.
Nice.
Weird way to see your beer. It's like real estates are using it now.
Yeah, exactly.
And what else, Rich?
So, look, that was the first step. Since then, we've put in a high-efficiency brew house that has what's called a mash press, so it's a different method of basically converting starch to sugar. But that uses a lot less water and less grain as well. And then we were very fortunate to work with the Pingala project, which is community-owned solar farms. So the solar panels on the roof of the brewery is owned by the community. We pay a lease for that. It's reducing the amount of power we take from the grid. I think we're making a saving and they're making a reasonable return on their initial investment. Mm. We're looking to expand that as well. So hopefully that can happen so we can take even generate more of our energy from those solar panels. We're taking all the power from the grid will be from a sustainable source very soon too. So we've signed an agreement with a solar farm to make that happen. And we've been working with UTS on a program around algae to do some research on that. So looking at capturing the CO2 coming out of fermentation to accelerate the growth of algae that will then go on and hopefully have another use.
Mm. Is brewing beer a high CO2 exercise, and this is why you can capture it and feed it to algae?
It's manufacturing, but the actual fermentation process generates a reasonable amount of CO2. It is young carbon, so it's been carbon that's been captured in the barley over a year's time. So some of that gets sequestered in the soil, some of that comes to us in the form of starch, which we convert to sugar, which the yeast then convert to alcohol, and then probably half of that goes out as CO2.
Okay. And so just, again, like with the algae thing, we were just down there before and we were looking at this green vat of, like, it looks like Avatar down there or something like that. You've got this glowing green cylinder in the middle of your brewery. Tell us exactly how that works again and what right, let's so go through is, it because I want to talk more about it. It's pretty innovative.
This is probably back to Oscar's point about like being able to come like follow like ideas, which maybe a big company would say no to. But we're very fortunate to meet Dr. Peter Ralph, who's head of the climate change cluster at UTS. And he asked us to come down and see what they were doing. And algae is a big focus for them. Several reasons, I think, looking at treatment of wastewater, potentially feeding either animals or humans with it. It can be used as a medium to grow pharmaceuticals. I think because of its use is so varied, they're seeing this as a potential game changer in terms of sustainability and carbon sequestering particularly. So after looking at it, he said, would you like to get involved? And I said, yeah, but I'm not really sure how. And then went away and thought about it and came up with this crazy idea of using it to capture the CO2 coming out of fermentation and then researching what we can do with that algae afterwards. Unfortunately, the rest of the guys thought it was a good idea to put some money into something that may not come to much. It looks like it will come to something though, which is very positive.
And so That green cylinder that you have down there, that converts the CO2 into oxygen. Does that cylinder eventually get taken away and replaced with a new one?
Yeah, Oscar? Absolutely. Yeah. So it's referred to as a bioreactor.
Yeah.
So it's 400 liters. There is generally 5 million algal cells, microalgae, per milliliter. And that bioreactor pumps out the equivalent amount of oxygen as a hectare of Australian bushland. Very interesting to think that the whole site of the brewery, you know, that one bioreactor makes more oxygen than the footprint of our business.
Yeah.
Which is really, really cool. And if you think about that as, you know, an urban business, an urban setting, how do you create more oxygen?
Mm. How do you take more CO2 out of the environment?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You know, you can't plant more trees, and the time it would take for the trees to actually grow to the size where they're doing a good enough job of it is a super long-term project. Whereas, you know, an algal bioreactor, which is 6 foot tall, can basically do that job, and the CO2 makes it reproduce at 1.8, 1.9 times the normal speed. So it's actually better for the algae. So it creates more cells and creates more oxygen.
Yeah, right.
It's amazing. Is and there anyone else using this in brewing or in any other business?
No, not that we've heard
you guys
of. We're
kind of forefront of it.
Well, it sounds like we are. So we've got a few more years to go. We really, like, this first year has really been to see if we can do it in the brewery and not kill all the algae and find algae that is sort of tolerant to the environment of the brewing as well, all the temperature changes. One that was highly CO2 tolerant. So you think that more CO2 is good for plants. In some ways it is, but there's a lot of species that that can't handle that increase of CO2 either. Mm. So we have found some strains that seem to thrive in that environment. It's now really working out a good use for that algae now that will, I think, if we can find another sustainable angle to it, then we have an exponential effect of what we're doing here. Mm.
Did you know that 50% of the world's oxygen actually comes from algae and seaweed?
Yeah, right.
No, yeah. I didn't know that.
Every second breath you take, it comes from either algae, microalgae, you know, kelp, nori, or spirulina.
Wow.
Seaweed's great. I love it. Like, seaweed should be eaten more.
We've talked a lot about seaweed on this podcast, especially when we're talking about foraging and things like that, and things that we pick up off the shoreline and Simon uses in his restaurant and stuff like that.
Super delicious.
Well, that's it.
Distiller about trying to make like some sort of spirit from seaweed.
Do you know what? I actually had a sort of slightly salty gin recently. Someone, I can't remember who made it. Mm. It might be Manly Spirits.
Yeah, they do like a coastal one.
Yeah, a foraged gin. So it's sort of like a savoury gin with... it's delicious, really good in an olive martini, turns out.
Like all seaweeds are edible as well. So it's like there's no poisonous seaweeds. Mm-hmm. So it's a massive food source we don't use.
Cows love it.
About it. Do they?
Oh, yeah.
Cows love seaweed.
Yep.
You're right. Didn't know that.
Feed it to cows.
Just learning.
Mm. So much going on.
Yeah. But do you know how hard it is to lead cows down to the beach?
They also love spent grain.
They sure do.
Which I guess is an
That's where all our grain goes. So it's been a real benefit to the farmers during the drought as well to come and pick up the grain from here. Mm. So that's been fantastic.
We're giving out around 8 tons of feed a week.
Yeah, wow.
That's awesome.
Which is, pretty significant considering that you can only use spent grain up to around 10% of a cow's diet. Right,
yeah, okay.
I believe.
Mm.
And so you've got numerous farms and stuff who come up here and pick it up?
There's a couple. So some of it goes out near Windsor, I think, and down the Southern Highlands as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. It must be a good feeling sort of developing relationships with people in the world of food and brewing and those sorts of things.
Our beef in a restaurant from Southern Highlands, so maybe some of our beef has been fed on Young Henry's grain.
Down at the majors.
So. Put on the menu.
It is really nice. It is really nice for us to be reminded of the fact that we are, we are closely linked to agriculture.
Mm.
You know, we use grains and hops, that are grown in Australia.
Mm.
And I guess the spent grain being donated back to farmers is just sort of closing that link in a nice way.
Yeah.
You know, if we think about, like Rich mentioned before, that the farmers have really appreciated the spent grain during the drought, which is absolutely true. But we've also, our cider, our apple prices have gone up 30% in the last year because of the drought. The diastatic power, which is the fermentability of the grains, have changed due to the drought. You know, would there be a lot of people concerned about hop growing? You know, if this drought continues,
certainly conscious that we're at a the end of a long growing process, and a lot of care has gone into getting those ingredients to us before we kind of turn that into beer as well. So we're taking the team down to Hop Harvest again this year, which is it's a great experience, I think, just to talk to the farmers, go and see the hops on the vine.
I think that's one thing that the craft beer industry has really done, which is amazing, is really shone a spotlight on the producers that contribute to producing good beer.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, before the craft thing happened at all, like no one had heard of particular hop farms or whatever it might be, and there was no recognition of the passion that goes into growing these sorts of
types of hops or types of grain they were using before craft beer came around. So
I think the hop farming market in Australia was really like a commodity. It was all around bitterness. It was about that alpha acid which makes bitterness in beer. It was just the price for that. That's all people cared about. And when you turn the focus onto flavor and aroma, it became much more interesting. And it was only through that process that I think the hop farms down in Tasmania were able to really turn their business around and start thriving.
Also with the addition of people dry hopping their beers, making pale ales, XPAs, IPAs, the amount of hops people are using per litre probably went up by about
factor of 10.
I think so. You know, so all of a sudden they're just sitting on these hop filled gold mines.
Does that have an effect? Like, does that demand? I mean, how's the Australia? Do you know much about how the industry is coping with that demand?
They're well oversubscribed. So fortunately, they do allocate a lot to the local market before they take it overseas.
But yeah, okay.
I do know that if I travel to the States, for example, and some of the brewers ask me what I use, and I say, oh, we use a lot of Australian hops, we use Galaxy, they're like, oh man, Galaxy, I can't get any of that. You know, like good. Yeah, good.
And that's one of the cool things about the Australian sort of craft market is that because of the great hop grown regions in Tassie and Victoria, and because of the great trademark hops like Galaxy that Richard's talking about, we actually have our own flavor profile. An Australian pale ale is it actually has a flavor and aroma which is different to pale ales around the world, because if you're using Tassie hops, they present very differently to how other, American or Kiwi hops.
It's great to have something that is unique to Australia that makes an Australian beer style. That wasn't really there.
Mm.
We're fortunate when we started that they really started getting into flavour hops. I think, if you remember, we were like, oh, wow, we can really make that a focus of what we do in all our core range beers. And we were using 100% Australian hops when we first started.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting, and you bring up an interesting point, which is this craft beer boom in Australia, like, has allowed Australian beers to have their own style and identity. Like, everyone's different and stuff like that, but a lot of the, like, places reflect the where they are. We're such a massive, massive country with such a broad landscape and broad climates and things like that, but there is a sort of a link between all our different beers based on, like you say, the hops and all these sorts of different things that give us a unique sort of Australian beer.
It gives them a sense of place.
Place, like, yeah, exactly.
Like, with wine, it'll just be like a representation of the area in the country. And if you've got an Australian hops, then it does give it that. And it's quite a recognisable hop in a beer as well. Even me, I'm not a massive, a huge beer drinker, I'm not like a beer head, but I can normally almost pick out like Galaxy hops, where they're quite apparent, and it's quite cool that that's a thing.
Yeah. That's the lucky thing with brewers, is that unlike wineries, who they are linked to their terroir, and they have one crack at it per year.
Yeah.
If one of our hop farmers or malt farmers has a bad year, we can sort of
you can
you know,
navigate it,
shift and stuff like that. But winemakers only really have to make wine once a year, whereas we have to make it every day. So yeah, they kind of win on that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They get 6 months of a year off.
Got to figure out something else to do. Guys, well, coming in towards the end of it, let's give you guys the opportunity. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about? Like, is there any things in your industry that we don't know about that you guys want to talk about? Or is there anything coming up for Young Henrys that you guys want to make us aware of? Like, we talk about all sorts of different issues on this show, and we don't shy away from, you know, going deep into some problems or, you know, challenges and things like that. Is there anything that you haven't discussed that you want to have a chat about?
Do you know what? One of the things I think that we haven't touched on that has been a really important part of the Young Henrys journey is our understanding of and love for the hospitality industry.
Mm.
Mm.
You know, there are many, many brewing companies when we were starting out that were just, they were brewers. They were brewers and they made beer.
Yeah.
And we, through trying to be open and interested and... We've got a really great relationship with so many of our customers, and in a weird way that has been an advantage to us. You know, learning what is selling and what is working from people in the hospitality industry, yeah, who are actually really, they're the tastemakers. They're the people who are talking to people, oh, yeah, on the front lines every night saying, you know, why don't you try this? Are you enjoying this? What else are you drinking at the moment? Being able to have relationships with people, hearing those conversations firsthand, has always been a massive feather in our cap. Mm. And it has allowed us to sort of...
There's a... If you're friends with the brewer or the winemaker or they're local, or you sort of have a relationship with them, you are so much more likely to push that product to a customer. If someone comes up and says, oh, I don't know what to drink. Like, if you have a relationship and you know that person, you know, they come into your bar, you really are just going to try and push that because you have that relationship there, and that is a massive difference.
A lot of our staff are, you know, from the hospitality industry to start with, aren't they? And you know, Oscar, you spend a lot of time behind the bar as well. Mm-hmm. So did, you know, Ben Joseph, with one of the other guys we started the company with. You know, I was more on the receiving end of the bar most of the time.
Still valid, valid experience though.
Good place to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get it from all angles.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and I think that it's something that can't be underestimated in terms of being a part of the broader industry that you're a part of, not just being a part of the brewing industry, but being a part of the people who buy it and the people who drink it and things like that as well. Like, that's invaluable, and understanding how that industry actually works and having constant feedback about it.
Quite a lot of, maybe an assumption on my part, but quite a lot of craft beers seem to be made for almost other brewers, where, like, if you're really into beer, you end up enjoying those stronger, weirder, out there flavors. And I find a lot of beers just be like overly hopped and overly bitter. You guys coming at it from, you know, working behind the bar and just frequenting bars, and kind of knowing what the customer wants to drink rather than what you kind of want to drink. You think that helped in the style of your beers?
Yeah, we certainly had that feedback from a lot of, actually some of our food critic friends were saying, well, we like drinking your beer with food because you're not overpowering it and knocking it out most of the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's true with particularly our natural lager. It's a great beer to have with food.
Mm.
For those reasons, yeah.
I think that, you know, beers can be different things to different people, right? So our core range beers, we've always made, like Newtowner, Natural Lager,
yeah,
you know, Stayer. They're everyday beers. They're simple, they're refreshing. Like, we're in a hot country.
Yeah.
Let's make a beer that people want to drink at the end of a hot day.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not a thinking beer, it's a drinking beer, right? And then our limited release stuff, that's where we play around. We get creative and we actually, you know, get to do those sort of slightly beer nerdier beers where you're probably only going to have one and you might talk, you know, might buy one and share it with your friend who's also a bit of a closet beer nerd, you know. You're not going to drink jug after jug of it at the pub. And, you know, both of those things are correct. You know, there's no wrong thing there, but we have always really tried to be an inclusive brand. And just because we're a craft beer company doesn't mean we need to be making these ridiculous, exclusive, you know, beers that only a very small percentage of the population can enjoy. Like, we want good beer to be enjoyed by everybody, because really that's the end goal, right?
Perfect. All right. I reckon we'll leave it there, guys. I guess I just want to finish by saying maybe you guys don't get too much of an opportunity to just step away from where you guys are in the thick of everything, but it's an awesome beer. Simon and I drink it regularly. His post-work drink is actually a tin of cloudy cider down at Howling Wolf in Wollongong.
So much. That just picks me up, wakes me up after a long
and,
shift.
And Young Henry's is a recognisable.
I was pretty happy when it made the top five of the Drink Easy.
There you go.
As well. Cool, I was like, man. I've been telling you it's the best beer in Australia. Cider.
Yeah. I mean, you got, it's a really recognisable and now sort of ubiquitous thing around hotels in, like, all up the East Coast. I don't know. I haven't travelled too much and checked it out. Yeah, but
it's almost a staple in Wollongong now.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. We've got some really great customers throughout that region who've been with us for, like, quite a long time as well. Mm. You know, Howl & Wolf.
Yeah.
You know, Illawarra, Scarborough, Lala's.
Oh, yeah. It's recently opened. Yeah. It's a cool venue.
And there's a few others that I'm probably not.
I went to uni at Wollongong, so to see the beer at North Gong was a special moment for me. Seeing Tumbleweed and the Hard-Ons there and all those
events. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's awesome what you guys have created, and the fact that you've kept the quality, kept the values, built a team, and built a beer that means so much to so many people is such an awesome achievement. So congratulations, and keep doing it, because everyone loves it.
We will love it. Don't you worry about that. Thank you very much, fellas.
All right. Cheers, thanks guys. Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning into that episode of The Food Fight featuring the Young Henrys. We really appreciate those guys taking their time to talk to us. If you want to find out more about what they do, you can go onto their website, younghenrys.com, or you can find them on social media at Young Henrys. If you want to find us, you can get to us via email at thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We'll answer questions from the audience, and feel free to give us some tips and some suggestions on potential guests or topics to cover in the podcast there. You can also find us on social media at The Food Fight Podcast. And you can find me on social media at Quicksand Food. You can find Simon on social media at Simon Evans Caveau with underscores. And you can check out his businesses, Caveau Restaurant and Night Parrot Wine Bar here in Wollongong. If you want to leave us a review on iTunes, that'd be fantastic. It'll really help us continue to grow this podcast. And if you want to subscribe, you can just search The Food Fight Podcast anywhere where you get them. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next episode.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.